Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:35 p.m. on Tuesday, March 29, 2016. Present, we have Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Sadler, Co-Chair Representative Newman, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Edgemond, and myself, Co-Chair Thompson. And I'm sure the rest will be joining us shortly. Before we start, remind everyone that cell phones and electronic devices are not allowed in committee. On today's schedule, we will continue with Senate Bill 74, sponsor Senator Kelly. Today, we will review the fiscal notes from SB 74, and the following department's fiscal notes will be reviewed in this order: the Department of Law, the Department of Administration, the Department of Commerce and Community and Economic Development, and the Department of Health and Social Services. Here to go over the Department of Law is Mr. John Skidmore, who is the Director of the Criminal Division. Mr. Skidmore, please come to the table, place yourself on the record, and begin your testimony. Representative Munoz has joined us also.
Good afternoon. My name is John Skidmore, and I am the Director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. The fiscal note that you should have for the Department of Law as it relates to this bill asks for a couple of positions to be placed into the Medicaid fraud unit of the Criminal Division. We had originally contemplated placing the positions in the Civil Division as opposed to the Criminal Division because this would be dealing with civil work as opposed to criminal. However, we elected to move them into the Medicaid Fraud Unit instead. The reason for that is that Medicaid Fraud Unit has a 75% federal dollars matched for 25% state dollars. So we're able to do the work at less cost to the state in that manner, which is why we've suggested placing them there. I believe that the fiscal note has changed slightly since its last version. The only way in which the fiscal note has changed is that it is indicating that it is general funds with the federal match for the reason that I just indicated, because the federal government would be paying 75%. So it was changed from a strictly general fund to a general fund with the federal match because of that.
We're addressing OMB component number 2203, dated 3/18/2016. Representative Wilson has a question already.
That was the question. I was just trying to make sure we had the most current ones, because we've got a whole bunch of different ones.
OMB component 2203, it's in the packet that we added to your...
Well, I apologize. I didn't realize you all might not have it directly in front of you. I should have pointed that out.
Continue.
That was basically the testimony that I had in terms of what's proposed there in the Department of Law's fiscal note. I'm happy to answer any questions about it if there are questions. I wasn't going into details of the bill, though I can do that if that's helpful for anyone.
We're going to do a brief at ease. We're back on the record, and we're on Department of Law, OMB component number 2203. Do we have any questions at this time? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Skidmore, this is a flat $365,000. Do you anticipate any recovery of Medicaid fraud unit, Medicaid fraud seizure or recovery of fraud proceeds that would help diminish that fiscal note?
Yes. In terms of the actual recoveries, it's somewhat difficult to tell you what the recoveries are going to be since we don't have the cases in front of us yet. But based on past year's recoveries, we anticipate that the amount of monies that could be recovered from the False Claims Act would more than cover the positions and the 25% that are listed there for you.
Representative Sadler.
So I'm sorry, so the 365 does or does not include your anticipated recoveries? I mean, I don't see the figure going down at all here. Are you saying that $365,000 a year is after recoveries or before recoveries?
That would be after. I'm sorry. Let me make sure that I'm through the chair. Let me make sure I'm answering your question correctly, Representative Sadler. The 365, because it is based on general funds and there weren't funds going directly to the Department of Law, I don't know that it's reflected there, but it's the anticipation of the Department of Law that recoveries that would be going into the general fund would be, I want to say the figure was above the 300 number there that you had. Thank you. Above the 365 that you had in front of you, and the change in revenues should be reflected down at the 500 down below. So where it says positions and then change in revenues down below that, it was 500,000. So that's obviously above the 365 that you had up in the fund source or in the operating expenditure.
Representative Sadler?
I think that covered just for the record. We're talking about you anticipate receiving or recovering getting $500,000 more, $500,000 in, and the fiscal note shows $365,000 out.
Correct.
So leaving a net of 140, 135.
That's correct.
Got it. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on page 2 of 3 at the bottom, the very last paragraph, when we're talking about both the proposed Medical Assistant False Claim and Reporting Act and provision on seizure and forfeiture of real property require involvement of the Department of Law. So this bill is giving you authority that you don't currently have on the civil side?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the answer to your question is yes. We do believe that the False Claims Act would allow us to pursue cases that we're not now able to pursue. We're only able to pursue criminal cases at the moment. This is allowing us to pursue some civil cases as well.
Follow up?
Representative Wilson.
So you're able to pursue them, and then also does it add not just fines but also forfeiture as well?
Well, the False Claims Act, excuse me, through the chair, Representative Wilson, what the False Claims Act does is it allows the state to pursue claims of fraudulent billing into the medical system, and in paying back the money that was from that, you can call it restitution if you want, but that's really what the forfeiture is talking about, is monies that have been billed fraudulently that then the state is able to collect on. Whether you call that restitution, whether you call it forfeiture, the idea is we're collecting the money that they never should have received to begin with.
Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg, followed by Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, the one lawyer on the committee is not here right now, so you've got a certain amount of reprise, I guess. So on page 2, the second paragraph from the bottom, certain actions would be barred, actions based on evidence known to the state. How do you define that? If somebody knows about a fraudulent action going on with a provider and a state employee is complicit in that, is that considered known to the state, or how does that work?
So through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, when we say known to the state, what we're really talking about is known to the lawyers that are going to be prosecuting the case, not some state employee that may be involved in the fraud themselves.
Okay, so just to expand that, I might be a little dense on this. So at what point somebody blowing a whistle and taking action would be precluded from being party to that if the lawyers know about it but haven't brought the case, or just if the state's lawyers know that there would be no action taken by the individual? This is, I mean, if I get this right, this is like whistleblower stuff. I'm just trying to understand that.
Give me just one moment and I'm going to answer your question.
Okay.
So through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, what they're talking about in that section is that there are times at which there may already be an investigation, a criminal investigation that's ongoing.
Okay.
And so what it means is I have information that Dr. A is fraudulently billing Medicaid, and I have investigators that are working on that. And I have citizen who comes forward and says, hey, I know that Dr. A is doing something wrong. We're able to say, yeah, no, we're already working on that, so you're not going to be pursuing that. That's what you're barred from doing. We're going to be pursuing that ourselves. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. And Mr. Chair, if I
look. Representative Guttenberg.
So the department is funded, what did you say, 75%? But because the way you put the these assistant attorney generals, 75% by the feds. When you get when you take an action and you prevail and the state prevails and you get you get the money back, how is there a division of those rewards within the same way 75% goes to the feds and 25% stays with the state for costs?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, you have asked an excellent question. There is a division between the state and the feds, but instead of being 75-25, it's 50-50.
Okay. And if I may, on the same line.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. So what about the division between where the fraudulent funds come from? What happens when the fraudulent funds are returned, and how is the formula for who gets what different from the rewarding of the attorneys? Is that different? So where the fraudulent activity took place, right? Maybe it was 75-25 or 25, I don't know, whatever the calculation was, or how the person fraudulently got the money. So there was a calculation on how much was federal and state that they took, and it's different for how the rewarding goes back to after it's won and returned to the state. It's different for the, well, it's 50-50 for the state and feds for the attorneys. But is there a difference? Do you see what I'm saying? I'm trying to talk through my clogged sinuses. So if you
through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I'm not sure if there's something I've said that's confused you. If there is, I apologize. Let me try and explain it this way, though. The program itself, the Medicaid program, is one that is a federal program. They give dollars to the state for distribution. What they do in terms of combating that fraud is we set up what's called the Medicaid Fraud Unit, and the positions in that unit, everything about the unit, is funded 75% mm-hmm. from the federal government. The state only has to put up 25% of that unit.
Yes.
When we find that there is fraud that has occurred within Medicaid distributions that have occurred by the state of Alaska, and we go to recover those, our efforts are funded 75% by the federal government, 25% by the state. Anything that we recover as the result of that is then split. 50% goes back to the federal government. We keep 50% of the proceeds. So on page one, where we indicated that we were going to be having an intake of $500,000, that's the state's portion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've answered your question.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Senator Guttenberg.
Your assumption that it's all federal money that the state's doing the program from that was fraudulently taken. My assumption is that not all of it was federal, that there was a federal-state match. But that's okay. You answered the question.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Guerra has joined us. Representative Munoz, you have a question.
Thank you. Thank you. What are the penalties under current law for a civil fraud violation?
Through the chair, you're asking the penalties in civil law for fraud right now?
For Medicaid fraud. Do we have penalties in current law?
I'm unaware of any. I may not be the best person to answer that question because I don't handle most civil cases. We do have another person from the Department of Law in the audience who might be able to answer that, but I don't believe that we currently have the ability to go after folks for false claims in the way in which this statute sets it up. This is something new for the state of Alaska.
Okay. And then as a follow-up to that,
Munoz.
What distinguishes between a civil fraud case and a criminal fraud case in current law? Where is the line?
So through the chair, Representative Munoz, the answer to your question is that a person does not receive a criminal conviction for which they could potentially go to jail. And because there is not that penalty to one's liberty, there is also a lower burden of proof associated with a civil case, which would be a preponderance of the evidence as opposed to beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Further questions to Mr. Skidmore?
Yes, sir.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Do you have a copy of the bill, by chance, available to you?
I do not have a copy of the bill in front of me. Sorry. I can get one, though. Is there a particular provision and page you're looking for?
It is, actually. It's on page 7. There is a – with permission, I'll just read the paragraph I got a question relating to.
I have a copy now in front of us.
Page 7, lines 17 through 20.
Okay.
Which says that if a beneficiary of an intentional or inadvertent submission of a false or fraudulent claim – who later discovers the claim is fraudulent or false, shall disclose that to the state not later than 60 days. My question is, someone who discloses within that period of time is still subject to any interest or penalties for an overpayment, to your knowledge?
I'm afraid you've asked me a detailed question about the bill that I would have to read more in depth to answer it. I really understood the fiscal note, which is what I was prepared to testify about. I'm happy to look into that and get you an answer, though, later today.
You can get it back to my staff. We'll distribute it to all the members.
Absolutely.
Thanks. We've been joined by Representative Gaddis. Is there further questions of Mr. Skidmore? Seeing none, Mr. Skidmore, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we will review the fiscal note for the Department of Administration. Here to present the fiscal note is Mr. John Boucher, who is the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration. Mr. Boucher, please come to the table, place yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Boucher, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration. The Department of Administration's role in the bill before you is in Section 40. Section 40 requires the Department of Administration in collaboration with the Legislative Finance Committees to procure a study to determine the feasibility of creating a health care authority that could coordinate health care plans, consolidate purchasing effectiveness for state employees, retired state employees, retired teachers, medical assistance recipients, the University of Alaska, state corporations, and school district employees. The study must be completed before June of 2017. And the main task of this is to determine the feasibility for the authority to study the needs to understand current suite of benefits, cost sharing, and payment for all employees and individuals whose health care benefits are funded directly or indirectly by the state of Alaska. This study will require an evaluation of a number of health care benefit delivery programs funded directly and indirectly by the state. When the department did some research on similar type studies, we found that just looking at subsets of this, for example, the Hay study of several years ago, we were looking at 350,000 or so. So we've estimated that the cost of this study could be up to 700,000 to complete. This will be a very ambitious project and will require a project staff to manage it for a little bit over a year. Including the three-month period following June of next year, essentially to wrap up the study, coordinate, review all the input and output from the proposed review and comment period, as well as taking a role in guiding the agency on the next steps.
All right. Representative Wilson has a question.
Just to make sure we have the right one, can you just tell us how much you have for the 2017 and then I have that one person's hired?
Yes. Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, $834,600 in fiscal year 17 and $33,600, which would be a quarter of 3 months of that staff.
Thank you. Just want to make sure I had the right one.
Yes.
Yeah, we are on OMB component number 45, dated 3-6 of 2016. Other questions from committee and Department of Administration? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boucher, to your knowledge, is there any existing you mentioned some studies that have already been done. Would this have to be a kind of ab initio study, or is there information that the department has already developed elsewhere that would be a useful foundation for this study?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I believe there's specific direction to try to leverage previous studies, including the Hayes study, but this has such a broad group of programs that we're looking at. We do feel that we'll still need to do a significant amount of data collection and gathering.
Thanks.
Further questions from committee? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Boucher. Is it your impression that you're going to do this in-house, or are you going to contract some of this out?
Through the chair, we envision that this would be a contract.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions from committee? Mr. Boucher, thank you very much for your presentation on that physical note.
Thank you,
and we'll now review the fiscal notes from the Department of Health and Social Services. Here to review the fiscal notes, Mr. John Sherwood, who is the Deputy Commissioner of the Department, and Mr. Jeff Jesse, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And they will testify on Mental Health Trust. Mr. Sherwood, Mr. Jesse, please come to the table, place yourselves on the record, and begin your testimony. Oh, I skipped one.
At ease.
I'm not very sharp here. Okay, now we're going to back up, reload. Now we'll review the fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Here to review the fiscal note is Ms. Janie Hovington, who is the Director of the Division of Corporations and Professional Licensing. Ms. Hovington, come forward, place yourself on the record, and we'll hear your testimony, and we are reviewing OMB component number 2360, which is dated 3-7 of 2016. Excuse me, Janie. Go right ahead. Place yourself on the record.
Great. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Janie Hovington, and I am the Division Director for Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. This bill affects our division in two ways. The first, it expands the PDMP, or the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. This is where it'll require pharmacists or practitioners who dispense or controlled substances to submit to the board for inclusion in the controlled substance prescription database on a weekly basis. It requires a pharmacist or practitioner who prescribes or dispenses controlled substances to register with the PDMP in a format established by the Board of Pharmacy, and requires them to notify the other board members or the other boards. It also allows the licensed practitioner or dispensers or licensed pharmacists to delegate access to the PDMP to employees on their behalf. For that, the expansion of this PDMP will require a program coordinator. That would be a range 18 here in Juneau, which would include the expanded registrations, reporting, collaborations, and engagement with the state opioid control program, grant writing and reporting, vendor solicitation, and other facets of that database. The second way it impacts the department is the expansion of telemedicine. This is both for medical and for social workers, professional counselors, psychologists, psychological associates, and marital and family therapists. And after we have already seen the limited expansion back in 2014, we know the volume that increases for licensure. And we anticipate that we would need two additional occupational licensing examiners to review those increases, and also two investigators. Additionally, the fiscal note would provide for $3,000 for travel for the new program coordinator to attend the pharmacy meetings. And then we have some regulation and legal costs, some printing and postage for $12,000, and We anticipate that there will probably be some extra legal costs and investigations in future years because of the increase and because of the distance of for telemedicine, people being out of state, it is a little bit more costly to conduct investigations across state lines for a total of, in the first year, $560,000. That would be a total for the two different sections and five additional employees.
Questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Huffington, with the prescription drug monitoring database, I see you're taking would accept federal funds. Is there any other federal regulations that come with those funds? Generally, there's a carrot stick attached to federal funds.
Through the chair, I do not believe in the PDM program that there are any other carrots I could.
Mr. Chair, do you not believe, or do you know, not know?
I do not do not know for certain.
We'll follow up on that. Mr. Chair. Further questions, Representative Newman?
Not at this point.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I can read, you're taking notes. So the third line down from the first paragraph, the bill allows licensed practitioners and licensed pharmacists to delegate access to the prescription drug management on their behalf to an agent or employee of the practitioner. So a licensed practitioner or a pharmacist can delegate to somebody that can be somebody that has no experience, just somebody doing clerical work in the office. How far out does that leave a pharmacist or a practitioner in their licensing requirements to allow some to delegate their authority to somebody? If that's something that you can answer.
Through the chair. The licensee's license would be held liable for anything, any misuse or misconduct by the employee that they delegate to.
Mm-hmm. So,
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. Is it a common practice for pharmacists and practitioners to delegate authority to people that aren't licensed or have a certificate or something that gives them some authority, or just somebody that's hired the day before to go through the prescription drug database and do the licensee's work? Is that a common practice in other places, do you know?
Through the chair, employees regularly have access to files on patients and access to database, but really it is the licensee's license that would be in jeopardy for misuse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two questions for you, Jeannie. One is, do you know of any other professional licensing boards in which the licensed professionals can delegate their authority to access other information about an individual? I suspect the medical board does, but I don't know about psychiatrists or social workers or physical therapists or any others. Do you know of any others that allow the members to delegate that access to others, to agents?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I am not aware of any, but I can follow up and check on that. I am not aware of any, though.
And follow up?
Representative Sadler.
To be fair, your position is not to be an expert in each of these different practice areas, but about the actual operation of the board. So in that regard, I'm going to ask you a second question. Just to clarify, the expected expenditure of $607,000 would be matched by the revenues generated from the license fees charged to the licensees. So there's a net zero to the state. These fees will all be passed along to those licenses. Is that correct?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that is absolutely correct. We are receipt-supported services. All licensees pay for the costs of their program. So this would be spending authority to be able to spend their money.
And
Representative Sadler.
And understanding that the large part of the increase is expected to be the cost of and the licensing and verifying the qualifications for telehealth practitioners, I see only $3,000 a year for travel. Would it be envisioned that the services line, where would the necessary travel come from to, if it were necessary to travel outside of Alaska to investigate the fitness of a telehealth provider, would that come out of the services line or out of the travel line?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, right now I don't anticipate that our investigators would need to travel out of state to do any investigations. It is done through, there are some tools that we have in state. Right now, we already have licensees that are outside the state of Alaska, and we have certain tools that we can use, and we can cooperate with other states. The $3,000 is merely for the program coordinator to travel to the Board of Pharmacy.
Representative
Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I just misunderstood something. There's no federal funds in this particular fiscal note.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we are currently the actual database. A prescription drug monitoring database is paid for through a federal grant through the an RSA with the Department of Health and Social Services. It's not guaranteed, but right now they are paying for the cost of the the grant is paying for the database.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So will we see keeping that database going when the federal funds are no longer there? Is that reflective of this fiscal note?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there are several versions of that of PDMP going through my head right now, and I do know that there's discussion about creating a registration fee with the program that would help sustain it in the long run. I don't believe it is in the current wording of this bill. So the answer to your question in this bill, no.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
First of all, I think we need a corrected one because I need to understand exactly how much funding we're talking about for the federal funds that are currently or potentially could come in. And then if we're going to be hiring five more people, what is your anticipation of how many professionals will be required to register to, I'm assuming, access this database?
Through the chair, can you repeat that question?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, so you're hiring five more people because of the whole issue of the database now being here, as well as the telehealth portion of it. So you would just mention that you're looking at how much would you charge to register? So that would be self-sustaining once the federal funds were not there. So how many are you anticipating will have to register with this system? And are we talking about just those involved in Medicaid, or are we talking about professionals all together in the state that would need to put in prescriptions?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it would be, and I do not have the number, it would be all the you're talking about the PDMP again, aren't you? It would be because it's the Board of Nursing, optometrists, veterinarians. I think that there is approximately licensed individuals able to prescribe. I think it's about 8,000, approximately.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Not really a question, but if there's other funding going in here, like federal funding and then funding that we're also going to have to backfill possibly at some point, I'd like to have an updated number so we know exactly what we're talking about and the number of how many providers that we may be looking at to have to charge to maintain this system.
Fine. We'll get that information through my staff and through the members.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Newman.
On that point, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On page 3 of 3, second from the bottom paragraph up, talks about the prescription drug monitoring database that if you don't get the federal funds on that, we know that there's plenty of discussions going on about federal reform of Medicaid. So if we don't have that, it's paid for by the Board of Pharmacy Licensees, where the Board of Pharmacy Licensees are pharmacists around the state. Were they surveyed to ask and asked, did you know that your costs for your pharmacy license are going to have to cover the cost of this? Were they asked to discuss this issue with them?
Yeah. Representative Newman, through the chair, the Board of Pharmacy is aware that, and it does make them nervous because the intent of the original, when the prescription drug monitoring database was put under the Board of Pharmacy, they were concerned about that, and it was the distinct intent that the Board of Pharmacy would not have to pay, or the licensee of the Board of Pharmacy would not have to pay for the program. So far it has not, and that's why Representative Wilson, that this is the cost without any federal grant dollars to the program, because there's no guarantee for future federal grants.
Representative Newman.
Sure, on that specific point, for the last 3 years, the legislature has chosen to not fund the prescription drug monitoring database. The department has chosen not to abide by the request of the legislature and went out and found their own independent funding for this program. They were instructed not to fund it, that it wasn't found useful. But, you know, and then we hear all the budget restraints and a lot of crying and screaming from the department about how you're cutting and reducing our budget, but they can find other money for programs that the legislature said we don't want funded. Just a little more input on that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Newman. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the same point, I guess, when I hear us talking about this federal program, and I know that there's always criteria or requirement. So really what I guess I'm asking, and as we look through the process of PDMP, and I've had folks come to me and talk about Schedule 4 or not Schedule 4, so I guess my bigger question is there criteria to take the federal funds that we have to do for this PDMP? I mean, is there a requirement in order to get that money? And I think it goes to Representative Newman's original question when we first started talking about this. If we don't abide by it specifically, do we not get the money?
Representative Gaddis, through the chair, I'm not aware of any, but I would have to double check and follow up with the committee.
Thank you. And through the chair, you know, it's certainly been my experience that, you know, in order to get money, you got to play by their way. And so I would suspect so, but I'd appreciate a follow up. Thank you.
Ms. Hubbington, maybe you're not the right person to ask, but I'm curious, and this has been talked about quite a bit in this committee at different times, on the pharmaceutical tracking, if you want to call it, and information gathering, is that shared with the federal government on opioids?
Mr. Right. Chair, I am not. I'm sure.
Not the right person to ask.
Tomorrow I'll be better prepared to answer all, more of those detailed questions. I'll have the manager of the PDMP. Tomorrow is our designated time.
I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize if you already answered this. When we're talking about the portion of Senate Bill 74 that requires the pharmacist to be part of the controlled substance prescription database, does that apply to all physicians for all prescriptions, or only to Medicaid services?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, it would be all physicians.
Thank you.
Follow up, Representative Guerra.
No,
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, sir. Jeannie, brief question regarding the $108,600 legal cost for investigations and appeals. That's a pretty precise number. Just curious what you base that on. This is on page 3 of 3 in the services. I know that sometimes investigations can cost a lot of money depending on what kind of person you pay. Is that based on other boards' experience or specifically to the Board of Pharmacy?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, there is a formula or is probably based on past practice, but I would have to ask my admin officer and see what she, how she came about that. But don't forget that it is also affecting many other boards than just the pharmacy, and so it'd be an accumulation of past investigations probably, but I would like to confirm that.
And a follow-up, because this is a new expansion of the range of services and how they're provided by telemedicine, is just kind of a new, brave new world, and I don't know if the existing standard formulas would apply, so I just kind of probing how confident you are in that element of the fiscal note. Mm-hmm. I'd like no more.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we having a separate hearing on the database? Is that
tomorrow, I think.
Okay, yeah. I just want to make sure. I'll save my questions. Thanks.
Further questions of Ms. Evanton? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we go to the big stack. Now we'll review the fiscal notes from the Department of Health and Social Services, and here to review the fiscal notes is Mr. John Sherwood, who is the Deputy Commissioner of the Department, and Mr. Jeff Jesse, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And they will testify. He will testify on the Mental Health Trust. Mr. Sherwood and Mr. Jesse, please come to the table, place yourselves on the record, and begin your testimony. And as we go through these, give us the OMB component number and the date, just to make sure we're all on the same page. Mr. Sherwood, you want?
Thank you. For the record, I am John Sherwood. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. And I wanted to start out first by talking about a summary document the department prepared, which looks like this. It's a two-page document. There are many fiscal notes for the department in this bill, and some of the provisions affect more than one component. Some components reflect the impact of multiple provisions. It's hard to get a big picture of just of the impact of this bill just looking at the individual fiscal notes and trying to keep it all straight in your head. So we thought we would start with going over some summary tables. The first table at the top of page one is the fund source table. And you can see that this bill would result in a net reduction in general funds in FY17 of $31.6 million, growing to over $113 million by FY22. It also results in total fund reductions beginning in FY19 and growing through FY22. The second table is the positions table, and it combines both permanent and long-term non-perm positions in the table. We add 15 positions in FY17, including 4 to work on the enhanced tribal claiming, 8 of the positions in that year and extending for 3 years are non-perm positions intended to help healthcare services and senior and disability services with the transitions involved in the numerous program changes. And these positions are funded, the SAFE portion is funded by the Mental Health Trust. We see position reductions beginning in FY19. We peak at 17 positions in FY18, gradually paring back to 5 net positions as we achieve efficiencies as a result of reform. The third table is the capital budget cost, and you can see there that the capital budget costs are a total $10.4 million. And it's almost all 90% federal money. And most of these are around MMIS expenditures to make system changes to implement the various program changes. Finally, on page 2 is a table that shows the different measures in the bill that save money and has summaries of those savings. It does not include every provision in the bill that impacts the department, so it doesn't match perfectly to the fund source table on page 1. As you can see, by far the biggest reduction comes in the implementation of the federal tribal claiming policy. I should point out that those savings are also included in the budgets currently before the two houses. So
We've been joined by Representative Pruitt, and also I wanted to note that the bill sponsor, Senator Kelly, is in the room. Go ahead, Mr. Sherwood.
Thank you. I wanted to say a couple things about behavioral health while I'm at the summary level. The bill includes provisions to develop a more effective integrated behavioral health system and implement an 1115 demonstration waiver. While we don't project direct behavioral health savings, we do expect substantial savings and positive impacts throughout state and local government once the new system is in place. The biggest impacts will probably be on the criminal justice system, but we would also foresee possible savings to child protection and public assistance programs as well. But again, we have not determined a specific savings for those. And finally, just a little bit of history and perhaps to explain why Mr. Jesse is at the table. I did want to mention that a few weeks ago, after the bill had passed out of Senate Finance, the Mental Health Trust Authority met and committed to help finance Medicaid reform. And the fiscal notes you see today reflect some of those contributions. Others will be provided as direct support from the trust, and I believe later Mr. Jesse is going to talk more about that. But I think I wanted to be very clear that the department deeply appreciates the support from the trust in this very important endeavor.
Thank you, Mr. Sherwood. Looks like the first one we have is the Department of Alaska Pioneer Homes.
Pioneer
Go ahead.
Homes. Yes.
OMB component 2671, dated 3/17/2016. Is that the one we're going to next?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's the one I intended to cover next.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we start, Representative Sadler.
I got a question, too, on the overall before we go to the – thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, the overview it'd be kind of fun to see the compared savings of the – I'm sorry, the compared actual expenditures for the department over those same years compared to the savings, but that's available to me. So my question would be on the third chart, the capital budget costs. Is this for any particular year? Is this for the entire 6 years? And if it's for the entire 6 years, will they tend to be front-end loaded? Can you give me more information about the time span of the capital costs?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, you're correct. This is intended to cover the capital costs throughout the 6 years of the project, but most of these would involve probably expenditures beginning in year one or year two of the program.
Thank you. And the second question is, real briefly, is the savings measures on page two incorporated into the grand total chart at the top of page one?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes. These where savings are reflected on page two, they would be included in the summary information on page one.
Thank you. Also on the summary page, Representative Garrick.
Thank you. On page two of the summary, Mr. Sherwood, it looks like roughly 85% of the savings in 2022, $103 million of the savings, is coming from a combination of the federal tribal policy program and then the 1915 waivers. Federal tribal policy, that's many of us have accidentally called those waivers, but that's the new federal program that lets the state get full reimbursement for certain treatment of IHS and Medicaid-eligible patients, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct. The change in policy does allow that certain services provided by non-tribal providers through a tribal referral can get the 100% federal funds.
And through the chair?
Representative Guerra.
Just because I think I'm foggy-headed right now, and the federal tribal policy is both, it's a combination of travel and then treatment of authorized of IHS eligible patients who get treated in a non IHS facility, correct? That funds that the state was previously paying for.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct. A Medicaid eligible individual who's also an IHS eligible individual, their travel and services that they receive as a result of a referral to a non-tribal provider from a tribal provider, provided certain conditions are met, would be covered under the new policy.
And just finally on that, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask while you were just looking over there. But, and Mr. Sherwood, that's for those services, that's 100%, and it used to be a cost the state had to pay for?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct. Typically, the services would have been matched at 50% federal.
Okay. So it's gone from 50 to 100 for these services, through the chair.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, Mr. Sherwood, Representative Van Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Sherwood, I'm, just for clarification, I guess, on page 2, we look at what's in red. Usually when I see red, it in my world, it means that it costs the state, and when I see it in brackets, so are these decrements or are these savings? So at the end of 17, it's $33 million. Is that 33 in decrement, or is that expected savings?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, that is savings to the state. That is a decrease in our budget.
In UGF?
These are in UGF. Yes, the saving measures table is summarized in UGF.
Just clarification, Mr. Chair. So these are expected savings to the state and unrestricted general fund dollars?
Through the chair, yes. These are expected savings where you see the red in the parentheses. And some of the items in the early years do have an initial startup cost.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Sherwood, if you would reference each time that we change to a different fiscal note, the OMB component and the date, it would help everybody make sure we're on the same page. Go right ahead.
Thank you. The first fiscal note is going to be for the Pioneer Homes. That is component 2671, and the date is March 17th, 2016. Under the bill, Section 35 requires the Pioneer Home residents to provide proof of application to Medicaid and the decision letter regarding their Medicaid application in order to receive payment assistance. With this change in law, the Division of Alaska Pioneer Homes estimates it will increase Medicaid revenues, shown as interagency receipts, and decrease general fund expenditures by just over $1 million per year. So the it shows as a fund source change. It does not show as a change in expenditures of switching from general funds to interagency receipts of $1,666,700 each year.
Questions of Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, John, this level 3 is requiring the lowest level of care. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, level 3 is the highest level of care, the most intensive level of care.
And is that, through the chair, again, I understand the trend has been towards more people moving towards that level, towards level 3. This is the same dollar amount all the way through. Would you not anticipate having more fund source change from IA? More Medicaid coverage over time as more people progress to level 3?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I understand your point. I believe the director, Vicki Wilson, is on the phone. She may be able to provide additional clarification to that. But
okay.
Do you want to go to that?
Could I?
Okay.
Hello, this is Vicki Wilson, director of the Alaska Pioneer Homes, for the record.
Yes, go right ahead, Ms. Wilson.
We do expect that there will be increases in those level threes, but to make a calculation, we did not feel that we could accurately give a calculation because those numbers have held pretty steady throughout the years, although we have seen increases and decreases from year to year. So it was hard for us to make a projection.
Okay, Representative Sadler.
That's a great answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson.
Welcome.
Further questions on Pioneer Homes? Mr. Sherwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next fiscal note I'd like to discuss is the Behavioral Health Administration fiscal note. That is component 2665, and it is dated March 17th. So the bill calls upon the department to coordinate with the Alaska Mental Health Trust to manage a comprehensive and integrated behavioral health system. We will plan and implement significant behavioral health reforms and will apply for an 1115 waiver as part of this process. As a result of the changes made to the behavioral health systems, together with the anticipated use of an administrative services organization to perform many of the functions required for the 1115 waiver, the division expects to be able to reduce staff beginning in FY18. Staff would be reduced by 2 in FY18 and by 4 in subsequent years. This produces a reduction of $226,700 in FY18 and then $453,400 in FY19 and on. And one half of the reduction is general funds.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on page 2, it talks about how the savings will be realized in Department of Corrections, Public Safety, Court System, as well as the Office of Children's Services. Could you tell me how?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, I think the savings referred to is the benefits accrued to the state as a result of the as a result of reforming the behavioral health system and implementing the 1115 demonstration waiver for behavioral health. The actual reductions in this fiscal note are only relate to Behavioral Health Administration. As I noted earlier, we did not actually feel like we could predict or specify the savings we'd achieve in those other areas as a result of the improvements.
Follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
I'm not asking you how much. I'm asking you how it will affect these agencies. So Office of Children's Services, I'm not asking you how much money, but my understanding that most of these parents are in Medicaid. Most of their services that they receive are ones that are delegated by the Office of Children's Services. So maybe they don't have managed care like we think of it, but it pretty much is because they're told where to go for their services. So how does this program, this waiver, change and produce any kind of savings?
Go right ahead. Place yourself on the record.
Thank you. For the record, this is Karen Forrest, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. Representative Wilson, through the chair, what we're really looking forward to with behavioral health reform is being able to expand the access of mental health counseling and substance abuse treatment services across the state. And as we expand the ability of Alaskans to access those services, we anticipate that that will have a significant impact on other sectors of our communities, particularly those parents who are dealing with substance abuse issues, for example, through the Office of Children's Services and working to trying to get into treatment so that they can meet requirements in order to keep their children at home. So the more we're able to expand access and have a robust continuum of care for Alaskans, it will impact other service sectors across the state.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So could I get the data on how long our parents are waiting to be able to get the services that are necessary for them to be able to get their children back so we can better understand in what, whether we're talking about counseling, therapy, drug treatment, but if we could get actual numbers on how long our parents are waiting while their children are in custody of the state, that would be very helpful to better understand this fiscal note.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I think that data would be very helpful, and I look forward to working with Children's Services to see if that's something that we can gather, as well as working with Behavioral Health.
Appreciate it very much.
Can you gather that information, request it, and get it through to our staff so we can get it to the committee members?
We'll work on that, yes.
Thank you, Ms. Forrest. Further questions? Representative Newman.
Commissioner Co-Chair. Ms. Forrest, on page 2 of 2, it talks about new subsection in Section 30 that requires the department to seek 1115 demonstration waivers from the federal government, CMS. Does it just require the department to seek them demonstration waivers? Does it require the department to get them waivers? What happens either if they do or do not get them waivers?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the bill does require that we seek the waiver, and it is a negotiation with CMS, and so we will have to meet certain criteria in order to have our application approved, and we're very dedicated and willing to do that work and in order to reach some agreement. So I feel pretty strongly, based on some of the consultation that we received, that we will put forward a strong application. We know we need to reform the behavioral health system, and that doing so through the waiver with the legislature support is very important.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
I understand that you're going to seek this, but you said that it will need to meet certain criteria. What is that criteria?
Well, one of the, through the chair, Representative Newman, one of the important things that we have to meet is budget neutrality. So, in other words, as we look to create an more innovative ways of serving the behavioral health population, the federal government would like us, as we do that, not to spend more dollars than they're already spending. And so that budget neutrality is one of those key pieces. Other pieces are we have to create an efficient and an effective healthcare system. So we'll have to demonstrate health outcomes, for example. So there's a whole host of requirements that we'll have to meet, but essentially we have to prove that we're increasing the access, we're improving the quality, and improving health outcomes for the same amount of dollars.
Representative Vice Chair, Co-Chair Newman, I mean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I understand that you have to meet budget neutrality, and I think what that means is that if you're going to get federal funds, I don't know if that has to meet state funds, or that if you set your plan in place that it sets certain budget goals, that you have to meet those certain budget goals, that if they're not met, that those fees have to be, or other measurements that are required by certain criteria from the federal government. Is it going to end up costing, is it possible this could cost the state more money somewhere down the line?
Representative Newman, through the chair, no. We understand through the budget neutrality that we have to provide extensive information 5 years back and 5 years forward in terms of what the projections are, and there'll be very significant analysis on our part as well as CMS's part to look at the budget neutrality. In terms of the state dollars, we understand that our budgets will not be increasing, and we understand that we're moving more towards a Medicaid-based system as opposed to a grant-based system.
And I guess I'd just like to learn more about what the 1115 demonstration waivers are. I know that they go into some of the federal Indian health type things, but I'm not quite sure what they are for behavior health and how much they cover. And I'm just not sure what we're stepping into, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman, through the chair, it's true that some of those policy decisions will be made through the negotiations as we look at the costs going forward. I'm happy to put some information together about the 1115 behavioral health waiver and provide that to your office.
Thank you, Ms. Forrest. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brief question. I'm looking at the MTAR money for each of the 3 years is $291,000. But I also look at the helpful spreadsheet that the Mental Health Trust, Mr. Jesse, has provided, indicates for that component is $308,000. I don't mean to quibble over a couple $1,000, but just curious. The fiscal note is 2 days newer. Has there been a change in the estimate for the costs, or am I just finding a math error?
To the chair, Representative Sadler, which number are you referring to in the information the department provided?
This is on the fiscal note under fund source MTAR, $291,000 for FY 17, 18, and 19. And on the authorities chart, it indicates MTAR is $308,000. As I say, not a biggie, but just the discrepancy I just want to check out.
He's looking at showing the sheet you're using.
Yeah, I'm looking at this.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, in which fiscal note are you looking at?
I'm looking at the one.
The one you're addressing at this time.
No, you know, I'm sorry. I'm jumped ahead of the next one. I'm so sorry.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Never mind.
All right. Further questions? Seeing none, we'll move to the next fiscal note.
I was looking at the game when you were.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next fiscal note is Medical Assistance Administration, and it is OMB component 242, and the date is March 18th of 2016. The Medical Assistance Administration component is where many of the administrative and support components for the Medicaid program are located. Many parts of the bill impact this component, including fraud and abuse prevention, primary care case management, health homes, emergency room reduction project, and the coordinated care demonstrations. The largest portion of this fiscal note is for personal services, and two positions would be added to work on the primary care case management and managed care sections of the bill, the health homes and telemedicine sections, the emergency room demonstration projects. Those positions would be 50% federally funded. In FY 17 through 19, the state match would come from the Mental Health Trust. For FY 20 and beyond, this match would be general fund, and this would be the point at which these programs would be all would be demonstrating savings. We also propose adding four long-term non-perm positions for FY 17 through 19 with state match provided by the Mental Health Trust to assist with the startup of the behavioral health-related system changes to the MMIS to handle the increased workload related to fraud and abuse provisions and to work on the hospital emergency room demonstration. We've also increased our services line by $75,000 per year to accommodate the higher appeal volume around the fraud and abuse provisions, and that would be included in our funds which go to the Office of Administrative Hearings. Total amount for this fiscal note in FY 17 is $697,600 and falling to $679,900 in FY 18, and eventually dropping down to $316,200 FY 20 through 22. There's minimal general fund cost in FY 17 through 19, thanks to the Mental Health Trust Authority. It would be $57,700 the first year and $48,900 in FY 18 and 19. Beginning in FY 20, the general fund cost is 50% or $158,100 per year. So that's the general overview of it. Margaret Brody is available for questions.
Questions from committee members. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. On the fiscal note for OMB component 242, one we're on now, my question is this. On page 2, the third line down, there's reference to the provisions in the bill authorize the department to assess interest and penalties and overpayments, and I've got an interest in that. I don't know, can anyone give me an assessment of how much anticipated revenue would come from penalties and interest and overpayments, which I assume means overpayments to a provider?
The chair, Representative Sadler, that's correct. So, if I understood the question, you're looking for the amount that would be recovered?
Right. Just to give you an idea where I'm going with this, if there were some provision to give forgiveness to providers who disclose an overpayment and repay it within 60 days, I don't know if that would cost the state much in foregone penalties or interest.
Through the chair, there is information on the recoveries around the provisions in a later fiscal note, in the healthcare Medicaid services fiscal note, if you'd like to address it at that time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So basically the same place Representative Sadler was. So Health and Social Services can seize property from medical assistant providers. Do you have that authority?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, under the bill, we would have the authority when we've gone before a court and established a credible case of fraud to seize assets of a provider in order to protect the state from the provider dispersing those assets prior to fully adjudicating the case and recovering.
Follow up,
Representative Wilson.
So I just want to make sure I'm correct. So first of all, this is on a civil case, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I will have to review the statute. I know it applies to criminal cases, but I'm not sure that it applies to the civil cases as well.
I'm getting an indication from Mr. Sherwood, or from from the back of the room there, that it does not apply to civil cases, only to criminal cases. Is that correct? I'm getting edge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My attorney has confirmed it only applies to the criminal cases and not the civil cases.
Okay, because, Mr. Chairman, it's very confusing here when it says impose civil fines and then says seize property of medical assistant providers. I guess my bigger question, though, Mr. Chairman, is I would have thought this would have come under laws, fiscal notes. I'm just really surprised that Health and Social Services themselves as a area of health care services would be taking these to court versus law. So I find it strange that it's in this fiscal note versus the Department of Law that we already had, but I'm glad it's at least criminal, not civil, that we're talking about. I just didn't know they took people to court.
To the chair, Representative Wilson, I apologize for the confusion. I think this lead-in language was generally covering the provisions of the bill that addressed fraud and abuse and didn't necessarily mean to apply that there would be a explicit expense in this fiscal note for each of those activities.
Further questions from committee? Representative Co-Chair Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm looking back at the Menges Group, and I'm this world of acronyms that we live in, and I don't know, with this Menges Group, it's full of acronyms, and I'm trying to figure out this primary case management. It was not recommended in the Menges Group, but I look on page 2, sections 29 and 28, direct department to implement a primary case management. And these case managements, Medicaid case management, as they're calling it in this Menges Group, I thought was not, they came as
not recommending it.
Recognizing that or recommending them that we not do that. Am I wrong here? Just this world of acronyms that we live in and confusing things here?
To the chair, Co-Chair Newman, I think the Menges Group was not recommending broad-based implementation of primary care case management to the total Medicaid population. This bill specifically requires that we target certain individuals, including individuals with higher hospitalization, and that's very similar, if not the same, to the Menges Group recommendation to look at doing care management for people with high volume of hospitalization. So I think there's a little bit of semantics. You can do primary care case management very broadly or more targeted. This bill is maybe not as targeted as the Menges Group recommended, but not as broad-based as the Menges Group specifically addressed in their comment about not doing primary care case management.
Mr. Chair, can we get...
Co-Chair Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we... That's what I thought, but that's not what I think we've been hearing. You know, we heard from Menges that they had concerns about this, but yet this fiscal note says we're going to go ahead and do this. And I'm not sure why, if we hire consultants who say don't do this, we recommend not doing this. So if we could get a difference between what the Menges report is recommending or not recommending, and where specifically it says that in the report, because that's probably open to interpretation, and I'd like to interpret that myself, as compared to what you're asking for here, because we're getting direction from two different groups in two different directions, Mr. Co-Chair.
The Chair, we can provide that that explanation and that
you would please
that description.
All right. Further questions from committee? Seeing none, we'll move on to the next fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next fiscal note is for our Office of Rate Review, OMB Component 2696, and it is dated March 17, 2016. The Office of Rate Review sets most of our Medicaid rates. Sections 28, 30, and 31 of the bill all contain provisions that would require payment reform or innovative payment methods. Under Section 30, the Department would need to apply for a Lump 15 demonstration waiver focused on innovative payment models. We've assumed that we would issue a one-time contract for $500,000 in FY17 to analyze and implement the payment models, and then having an ongoing $100,000 contract in subsequent years for ongoing actuarial work for updating and maintaining the rates. Section 31 of the bill requires that there be an annual actuary report on the coordinated care demonstration projects. We have increased the ongoing actuarial contract by $100,000 to reflect that additional work, so the combined cost of ongoing actuarial services would be $200,000 a year from FY18 forward. So for the first year, the costs would be $500,000, subsequent years would be $200,000, and that would be 50% federal funds and 50% general funds.
Questions from committee? Seeing none, Mr. Sherwood, go right ahead to the next fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next Representative Sadler has backed up with a question.
Actually, yes, sir. I'm sorry. And I guess this is maybe more a policy question than a fiscal note question, but I was reminding myself here that there's a third on page two of the fiscal note. The last paragraph talks about the department contracting with a third-party actuary to review the demonstration projects. I guess now that I've got you all in front of us here, what was the thinking about having this mostly separate people on the project review committee and then having the actuary be the recommender for the description of the program? I didn't say that very well. So we've got the project review committee that will basically review the proposals for the study, and then once the study's done, it'll be an entirely different organization, a third-party actuary, to review the going forward. Is there any continuity between those two review bodies?
Through the Chair, Representative Sadler, I think the purpose of the actuary, and I don't want to speak for the bill sponsor, but as I understand it, really the purpose of the actuary is to do that independent evaluation. When you make a change like this, you compare it to some sort of baseline to determine how effective it is, and typically that involves an actuarial assessment to do that level of analysis. So I think the thinking is this would inform the department and the legislature as to how effective those demonstrations were.
So, Representative Sadler.
So the policy work would be done when they design the demonstration projects, and then the actuary would look at the numbers to see how well it worked, but would probably pretty much be required to accept the policy assumptions that have already been made and just make tweaks on the finances. Is that correct?
Chair Representative Sadler, I'm not real sure just exactly how the actuarial would go about that in terms of accepting the policy, in terms of evaluating the project as it was authorized and going forward. Yes, I don't think the actuary would be expected to speculate on an alternative design, but would evaluate the policy that was approved as it was implemented and as the data becomes available to determine whether it's achieving its intended outcomes.
All right. Continue, Mr. Sherwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My next fiscal note is fraud investigation, which is OMB component 237. dated March 17th. And this is a fiscal note from the Division of Public Assistance. It pertains to Sections 24 and 31 of the bill. Under Section 24, the division would need to contract with a third party to provide a computerized system of income, asset, and identity verification to deter and avoid fraud and public assistance benefits. The system under the statute would have to be cost-effective. It would have to save more than it costs. There is an FY17 cost to starting up the system of $650,000. This includes $250,000 to make changes to the eligibility system, ARIES, to allow integration with the new system into current work processes, and $400,000 for associated implementation costs such as documentation, user acceptance testing, training, and support. This is almost all state-funded, as certain aspects of this duplicate somewhat different but similar verification systems that are already built into the ARIES eligibility system, and the federal government has already paid for those. We would expect that there would be savings beginning in FY18. The division estimates that it would be able to reduce its staff in fraud investigation by one half of a position by deterring and identifying fraud up front before we have an individual receiving benefits. We would be screening out potentially fraudulent applicants, and so the number of investigations would, as a result, would reduce. So we anticipate a $46,000 reduction in personal services beginning in FY18, and this is 50% federal, 50% general funds. Section 31 requires the department to refer Medicaid recipients to community resources, the Department of Labor, and the university for education and career opportunities. We expect that this would require a one-time expense in FY17 to create notices within our eligibility system to support these referrals at the cost of $30,000, and that would be 75% federal funds.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So is this the same program that you can use for your super utilizers to see how many times that they've gone to the emergency room or, you know, or utilized Medicaid in any fashion?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, no, it's not the same system. It would be a different system that really looks at a variety of private databases that would allow us really, when we're making eligibility determinations for Medicaid eligibility and for other assistance programs, to determine, it would give us additional information as to whether somebody was residing in another state or shielding assets or having sources of income that we couldn't identify through our traditional means.
Follow up, Mr.
Representative
Mayor.
Wilson.
Well, it's my understanding that this system can tell you a lot of things if you want it to. So I'm just curious, instead of having a whole different drug database, why couldn't you make this program so that it could keep track of your super utilizers or it could keep track of billing as all your prescriptions all get billed to Medicaid? Why could you not use this same system to be able to do all the tracking that we've kind of been talking about for the last week?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I am not familiar with the capabilities of these systems in terms of actually tracking medical expenses, and it was not our understanding that was the sponsor's intention, so we didn't really look into that aspect of it. We haven't considered that as part of this analysis. It is something we could see if we could find additional information about the ability to do some of these things. I think we have other systems that integrate our healthcare spending information, and it might not be cost effective to try and bring in another system and try and put more of it into this system, which is really focused more around financial eligibility for individuals than for the healthcare spending.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Wilson.
I may not be the most technical person, but I remember when the system came out, how amazing it was supposed to be with all the money that we spent on it, all the things that we can do. And it just seems like if we have a system that can do a lot of these other things that we're talking about spending even more money on, we should at least find out whether or not it's capable. So if we could find out and they could let you know, might be able to save some money versus spend more.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess on that point, as we go through the process, I think somebody else, I think it might have been Mr. Somebody else asked for a side-by-side, if you will, of some of our reports. And so if we could have a side-by-side, if you will, of all the different systems or the databases that we're compiling in this bill and see where they may dovetail with one another. I mean, we talk about silos all the time, and if we as we go through this process, kind of think about all the different systems that we are putting together and where they can dovetail. So if I could request that along with the other side-by-sides. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Forrest. All right. Continue, Mr. Sherwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our next fiscal note is for Senior and Disability Services Administration. It's OMB component 2663, and the fiscal note is dated March 17th. So Section 30 of the bill requires the department to apply for a 1915 INK options, which will increase the federal funds received to provide home and community-based services. As part of this change, the Division of Senior and Disability Services anticipates implementing a new assessment tool for use in its existing waivers and for the INK option. We anticipate having to add positions to plan, develop, and manage the two options. We would add one permanent position in FY17 to begin the work and two more in FY18 as we start the options. We believe it's important to get the design and implementation of these options right. While they generate considerable general fund savings, we must ensure that eligibility requirements and service limits are well-designed and strictly enforced if we're going to achieve those savings. In addition, the Mental Health Trust Authority has agreed to fund the state's share of four non-perm positions for FY17 through 19 to assist in developing the data capabilities, provider certification, quality assurance, and policy development around these efforts. In addition to the cost of the positions, we would have costs associated with modifying the automated services plan, which is the Division of Senior and Disability Services Management Information System. We estimate that $550,000 costs would be spread out over the first 3 years, and it would be 90% federal. These costs are reflected in the services line. Also in the services line is cost in FY18 and 19, totaling $346,900 for assessing individuals for the 1915 I option. These would be individuals coming from grant programs to the new Medicaid option, and they don't currently receive that level of assessment. These costs are one-half general funds. The cost of implementing a new assessment tool would be $2,575,000. One half of it would be federal, and one half of it would be paid for by the Mental Health Trust Authority. FY17 costs in total are $3,157,500, but only $71,100 would be general fund. In FY18, the cost is $1,034,900 total, with about $297,000 in general funds. And the expenditures continue to fall, with the out years being $343,200, with half of that, or $171,600, in general funds. So I know I went through that fairly fast, but happy to answer questions.
And Co-Chair Newman.
Director Mays is.
Which OMB component number are we on?
Oh, we're on OMB component 2663.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Got it. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. I'm going to go back to the question I had a couple, my mistaken question of a couple back. I'm trying to look at the, again, the 2663, the fiscal note we're working on, looking at the MTAR money for FY19 is $146,800, and looking at the spreadsheet that Mr. Jesse, the trust authority, gave us, it's looking like on page 3, top line, the MTAR money for 19 is $213,000. I just want to understand the discrepancy between those numbers. Not, again, not trying to be persnickety, but when I see something that doesn't line up, I just want to understand it. And you've got, no, this is, it's actually, it's the top sheet labeled page 3, and it's the top line there for FY19, $213,000.
Yeah. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and Representative Sadler, through the chair, we'll have to confirm this with the department, but when we negotiated this overall package, we were working with some estimates of some of these costs, and that's what I had to take to my Board of Trustees on the 19th, and we didn't have time to allow the department to go through and really crunch the numbers. So in most cases, in fact, in all cases, the actual numbers are coming in slightly under what the trust has approved, and we'll just simply restrict those additional funds and plow it back into the trust.
Good. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Question? Further questions? Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jesse, I've got just an overall question on the 3 years of mental health contributions. So first year it's $2.15 million, and then it goes up to $3 million in the third year, roughly. In order to – what I don't want is just to see money shuffled around and for you to not – to serve one group of people and not serve another group of people, or transfer pay less here so general fund money goes up here and then goes down later on, or down or up. So if you contribute two and then up to $3 million for these first 3 years, are you going to displace services for any other beneficiaries? I mean, you only have a finite amount of money coming out of the mental health trust, so why don't you help me?
Yeah, Representative Garrett, through the chair, if you wouldn't mind deferring that question until we get through the department's fiscal notes, and my plan was to give you an overall vision of kind of what the trust's philosophy was and what we had to do in order to come up with this package of funding. Is that acceptable?
Okay. All right. Further questions? Senior Disability Services fiscal note. Seeing none, Mr. Sherwood, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next fiscal note is General Leaf Temporary Assisted Living. It's OMB component 2875, and it is the fiscal note dated March 17th, 2016. This fiscal note is the first of three consecutive fiscal notes that reflect the reduction of 100% general fund program funding home and community-based services as a result of implementing the 1915I option in Section 30 of the bill. The expenditures will be offset in later Medicaid fiscal note, where the expense will be 50% general funds and 50% federal funds. And this note is for the General Relief Temporary Assisted Living Program, which pays for assisted living home care for vulnerable adults who do not qualify for Medicaid home and community-based waivered services. With the implementation of 1915I, Medicaid will be able to pay for a substantial amount of the services covered under this program. So beginning in FY19, the program will be reduced by almost $4.7 million annually, all general funds.
Questions from committee? Seeing none, we'll move on. Mr. Sherwood. Representative co-chair Newman has a question.
Mr. Chair, I've noticed on both this fiscal note, on other fiscal notes such as 2663, that there's no money in the fiscal note for travel or other related services like that, yet in the fiscal note, particularly on this particular one, on the last paragraph, it says that change of the state plan and regulations are required to implement the new option would involve extensive public comment. And generally when things involve extensive public comment, it costs the state money to do that. But I see nothing in the fiscal notes about involving extensive public comment and the cost that it takes to do that in any of these fiscal notes.
Yeah, Representative Newman, through the chair, when we go through the trust package, what you'll see is the trust has agreed in a number of instances to fund the public process. It'll be more efficient and cost-effective for us to do that off budget.
Okay, we'll get to that one in a little while.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, go right ahead, Mr. Sherwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next fiscal note is Senior Community Grants, OMB Component 2787. Dated March 17th. As I said, there are going to be three very similar fiscal notes. This is the second one showing reductions to 100% general fund program as a result of adding the 1915I option under Section 30 of the bill. These senior grants pay for, among other things, adult daycare and in-home services, which could be covered by the 1915I option for Medicaid-eligible individuals. Beginning in FY19, these grants will be reduced by $735,200 per year in general funds to reflect that a certain number of individuals will now receive those services through the 1959 option.
Questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 2 of 2, again, OMB 2787, component number 2787. It talks in the second paragraph that sections 28, page 25, or lines 27 through 29, charge the department with, quote, reducing the cost of senior disability services provided to recipients of medical assistance under the state's home community waiver. If you don't get these other waivers and you're still directed to reduce the cost of disability services that are provided, what do you do besides just reduce the services provided? This says that you will reduce those costs. If these plans don't work as implemented, what's plan B?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Newman, we don't actually see a substantial barrier to getting the 1915I option approved, but if we should encounter such a barrier, I think we would have to look as probably first at different ways to control utilization within the program. Director Mays is in the audience, and he can provide additional information, but I think lacking our ability to use the tools in this bill, the natural way you reduce costs, it would generally be to look at controlling utilization as best you can to make sure that you're getting kind of the optimal benefit from the services you're paying for.
Representative Newman.
Well, Mr. Chair, here's the consternation that I'm having with this, is if they're required by statute, and if this bill passes, you're required by statute to reduce the cost of senior ability to services, but we don't even know what services that you're going to be reducing or by how much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Further questions from committee? Seeing none, Mr. Sherwood, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next note is Community Developmental Disabilities Grants, OMB Component 309. And this is the last of the three notes which show reduction in a general fund program as a result of 1915I option being implemented. The Community Developmental Disabilities Grants provide home and community-based services to support individuals with developmental disabilities. Under our projections, we would begin our 1915I option for this group midway through fiscal year 18, we would be able to reduce the grants of an annual amount of $11,635,000 $36,800, all of which are general funds, and of course for FY18 it would be half that amount of money. So that's the final piece of the savings. The community developmental disability grants are the largest grant program that would be refinanced by the 1915i option, and because of that, in terms of priority, the advice we got was you shouldn't try and do it all at once. We pick the services that would provide us the most savings to start first, and start that in January 1 of FY18.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, sir. Briefly, I recall that the budget we put forward had a couple percentage, 5% reduction in this grant line. So this would restore, this funding assumes FY17 as a baseline, is that correct? This would be a replacement of state money with waiver money, but at the same level of service. Is that a fair assumption?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, if I understand your question, I believe yes, it would be to replace the general funds in the grant line with the federal and general funds in the Medicaid option.
Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, just for all three of these waivers are temporary. They're 5 years with the possible renewing of 5 years. But at that point, then, they become programs that come back to us as a legislature to then use general funds again?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, these are actually options which don't have a specific time limit. There is for the I option, if you target benefits to specific groups, you have to come back and get reapproval of that targeting every 5 years. So, but as optional services, they're not subject to the routine renewal the way a waiver would be.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Munoz.
Will this change result in the same level of services or expanded services for this population of users?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, it's our goal to provide the same level of service to the same individuals we're currently providing, but through a different mechanism.
No further questions. Mr. Sherwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next fiscal note is for the Commissioner's Office. It's OMB component 317, and it's the date is also 317 on this one, so March 17th. So Section 40 of the bill directs the Department to conduct feasibility studies on privatizing the Pioneers Homes, certain Division of Juvenile Justice facilities, and the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, or API. To conduct the three studies, we estimate we would need $735,000 in FY17, all of which would be general funds. Section 38 requires the department to implement the new tribal policy, or the new federal policy on tribal Medicaid reimbursement. And this fiscal note includes the creation of a new tribal federal liaison section to aggressively move forward to implement the policy in order to maximize the enhanced federal claiming in the minimum amount of time. This section will be responsible for working with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, tribal providers and non-tribal providers on the development of implementation of referrals, care plans, and claiming for services provided to tribal members by non-tribal providers. Once implemented, the section will also provide oversight to the processes to ensure that we continue to meet the requirements for claiming the enhanced funds. This includes four positions at an annual cost of $579,400, 50% federal, 50% general funds. These positions are also included in the House and Senate budgets.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. You anticipated my question, Mr. Sherwood. Not sure if the cost for those positions, I believe they are allocated or accounted for in the operating budget. and here. So are we double dipping or what's going on here?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, this addition was put in as a result of discussions with the Senate Finance Committee. It's not in the governor's budget, so whereas normally there's that separate column for things that are already in the governor's budget, so it didn't seem appropriate to put it in there. We wanted it to be recognized as part of the package, and this was what we came up with after discussion, I would say, but we do appreciate, and we've tried to identify in the fiscal notes that there is potential duplication, and it's something that needs to be watched in the final budget process to ensure that we don't double dip, that we only get this once, and likewise we don't take on the other side of it in the service category, we don't take our reductions twice because those savings are also shown in both places.
So this is kind of, through the chair, this is kind of belt and suspenders, just to make sure to be sure. Another question?
Representative Sadler.
On page 2 of 3 here, the first paragraph under section 40, and this is kind of a follow-up on the budget as well, this talks about asking the department to conduct a study analyzing select facilities of the Division of Juvenile Justice for privatization. Can you help me understand when you see that select facilities, does that imply to you any particular facilities? Is it your call or is it?
Through Chair Representative Sadler, I think we understand it to be our call. There's, I think there's some logical choices to look at in terms of utilization and support, and my fellow deputy commissioner could probably, and former director of Juvenile Justice could probably give you more information if you'd like.
What's the hey?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, Mr. Sherwood did a nice job of answering that question.
But he passed it to you to answer, and you didn't answer it.
Well, same answer. Essentially, it's left to us. I think the language leaves it to the department to decide how to procure for that feasibility study. And certainly, there are 8 juvenile facilities. 4 of them are combined treatment and detention facilities, and 4 are more are smaller and more in the rural areas. And so, you have to look at sort of balancing the needs between rural and urban, as well as the utilization numbers. So, we'll do that.
I know you do a good job. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Forrest. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. It was my understanding that the department or the administration went out for a request of interest or letters of interest regarding the management of the permanent, or not the permanent fund, the Pioneer Home, to privatize it, and there was very little interest. Is that indeed the case? If you could speak to the results of that inquiry, I would appreciate it.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, we did put out a request for letters of interest regarding assumption of some or all of the responsibilities of operating the Pioneers Homes. And we received 4 responses. One was really looking at very limited management. One was, I think, interested mostly in one home, but also possibly other homes. 2 were from entities outside the state that operate assisted living facilities in other places. None of them was willing to sort of just take on the responsibility without substantial, I would say, substantial support continued from the state. So I think there is some interest, whether there is interest in really taking assuming as much responsibility as some people envision when they talk about privatizing the Pioneers Homes. I think you're right. There's probably not that sort of interest, or we haven't seen that interest at least yet, because the Pioneers Homes do operate with a substantial state subsidy and have provisions around ensuring that people's ability to pay doesn't keep them from receiving services in the home, and no one is willing to step up and offer to do that for us.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's 2 questions on section, it's on section 40 of the bill where studies on many state facilities are being asked for. And I guess the first question is, I mean, let's say you wanted to privatize these facilities, and I've got some questions about that. Let's say you wanted to. Why would the state spend money on a study? Why wouldn't you just invite people to say, here are the circumstances where we're willing to overtake the operation of these facilities? Why pay for a study?
Through the chair, Representative Garretts, it's my understanding that it's a requirement in our current bargaining agreements that if we are going to privatize current state employment, we have to conduct a feasibility study first.
Through the chair.
Representative Garretts.
I guess still, why don't you wait to see if somebody's interested in a way that satisfies the state before you do the study, even if you have to do the study? Why spend the money first to find out whether it's needed later rather than finding out whether it's needed first and then spending the money later?
Through the chair, Representative Garretts, I think one of the challenges, as we certainly experienced in the request for letters of interest, is that if you really want to get down to that sort of detail, you're asking people to invest a lot of money up front to do the analysis and prepare the proposal of what it looks like for them to take it over. And if you aren't certain that it's going to pass the feasibility test, you may not get the interest from people and the willingness to invest if you still have that feasibility study hanging over you. I think that's the thinking on that.
Representative Garretts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I just think we've addressed this issue so many times since I can remember back to the Palin administration. So let me ask you this. I know the Palin administration talked about privatizing. I know in the past we've talked about privatizing otherwise. Have we spent money on feasibility studies on privatizing the Pioneer Home already?
Through the chair, Representative Garretts, I'm not aware that we have. If Director Wilson has different information, she can correct me, but I'm not aware that we have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then finally, through the chair. When this issue came up under the Palin administration, do you know what efforts were made to look at privatizing the Pioneer Home?
Through the chair, Representative Garretts, I don't. We can look into that and see if we can find some information on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm concerned from this perspective, and I know Representative Munoz spends time at her Pioneer Home, and I know the legislators who have Pioneer homes in their districts spend time there. This causes a lot of angst by people who live there. I mean, it's not even close to an overstatement the amount of nervousness this creates for people every single time this comes up, and it comes up over and over and over again. I feel like we're plowing the same ground, causing a lot of worry by the same people every single time this happens, and I've got a concern about this provision again.
As our budget has caused consternation all over the state, from DOT to the university to the Department of Education. So, yes, I understand what you're saying, Representative Garretts. Mr. Sherwood, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next fiscal note is the Behavioral Health Medicaid Services fiscal note, and it's the first of the three Medicaid Services fiscal notes. This one for behavioral health reflects two different parts of the bill. First, the provisions of Section 28 and 30 to manage a comprehensive integrated behavioral health program and to do an 1115 demonstration project. And second, the provision in Section 38 of the bill to implement the new federal policy on 100% federal claiming on tribal services. With regard to the behavioral health redesign and the 1115 waivers, there are several different types of expenses. There are increases to the grants and benefits line to reflect the increase in Medicaid expenditures related to filling the gaps in our behavioral health system and eventually covering larger substance abuse treatment facilities under the 1115 waivers. This is a blended match rate for different Medicaid populations whose federal match rate varies between 50 and 100% federal. The waiver would begin in FY18 and grow over time. There are increases to the service line to reflect the cost of paying an administrative services organization to develop and manage a network of providers, manage utilization, monitor outcomes and audit for fraud, waste, and abuse, and that contract would also begin in FY18. The state share is paid for by the Mental Health Trust Authority through FY19. After that, it's 50% federal and 50% general fund. There's a two-year cost in FY17 and 18 for consulting contracts in the services line to assist the department in designing and implementing the managed care, the managed behavioral health care system, and developing the waivers. There's also a contract in FY17 and 18 to develop a prospective payment system for certified community behavioral health centers. The state share of these contracts will also be paid for by the Mental Health Trust Authority. And these expenses are all summarized in the table on the top of page 3 of the fiscal note. There is capital need of $2,348,000 for one-time system changes to our MMIS. That's 90% federal, with the Mental Health Trust Authority paying for the 10% state share. The other part of the fiscal note is to reflect the change in federal policy around claiming 100% federal funds for services provided to tribal beneficiaries. We estimate shifting some of the behavioral health services, particularly residential psychiatric treatment services, to 100% claiming from 50% federal claiming. So while this does not affect total expenditures, it does impact fund sources for behavioral health Medicaid, reducing the general funds and increasing the federal funds. The table on the bottom of page 3 of our fiscal note shows our projections for the shift for behavioral health services. Total FY17 appropriation request is $850,000 with no general funds. The note shows the FY17 tribal claiming fund shift in the column for the governor's request, as that portion was already included in the governor's request. In FY18, the administrative services organizations and the 1115 waivered services expenditures begin showing up in the operating expenditures, starting at almost $5 million. In FY19, these expenditures are almost $10 million. FY20, slightly over $14 million and just over $19 million in FY21 and 22. Looking at the fund sources for FY18 and beyond, you see that the savings in the tribal claiming more than offsets the increase in general fund expenditures until FY20, when the new general fund expenditures increase by $396,000. In FY21 and 22, the general fund increase is just about $1.2 million. However, as I stated before, as a result of the 1115 waiver, we do expect benefits to accrue to other divisions within the department and as well to the criminal justice system, the courts, public safety, and corrections, but we're unable to quantify those benefits at this time.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I'm getting tired of missing some of this, but I will ask a question on page 2, first paragraph. Mr. Sherwood, we earlier heard presentations from the folks at Menges and HMA and about the inability of other states to put to require employment services, that Medicaid recipients avail themselves of employment assistance as a condition of receiving Medicaid services. But in the middle of this, that we talk about the bill manages integrated behavioral health program, including housing, employment, and criminal justice. I guess I'm just going to ask you to address those earlier comments. Is it appropriate to continue to have in this bill the guidance to have this behavioral services plan address employment?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think there this reference is really talking about supportive services that can help people with behavioral health issues either obtain or sustain a program. There's probably people on either side of me who can describe that in more detail, but as opposed to a requirement that somebody work to get these services, what we're really referring to is the sort of supports that you provide to people addressing their behavioral health issues to help them get or maintain their employment.
Fair enough. Thanks.
Further questions? Seeing none, go ahead, Mr. Sherwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next fiscal note, second to the last fiscal note, is health care Medicaid services, and it is the most complicated of all the fiscal notes. I'll apologize in advance for that as I go through it. It's the Medicaid component for health care services. It impacts includes impacts from the many fraud and abuse provisions, the reform provisions, including primary care, health homes, telehealth, the health information infrastructure, emergency room project, coordinated care demonstrations, as well as the transportation piece of the tribal claiming policy. So several sections of the bill contain the provider fraud and abuse provisions, including the False Claims Act, the ability to assess interest on audit recoveries, provider self-review to identify overpayments, the authority to issue civil fines, and the ability to invoke civil forfeiture against fraudulent providers. These result in enhanced recoveries and abatements and are summarized in pages 2 and 3 of the fiscal notes. Section 28 provides for electronic distribution of explanation of benefits, or EOBs, as people often call them, to Medicaid recipients. We intend to use the MyAlaska portal for this. There's an initial setup cost of $707,500, half of which is general fund in FY17, an ongoing cost of $93,500 for a user license and maintenance fees. This is also half general funds. Section 28 also directs the department to provide for stakeholder involvement in setting annual targets for quality and cost effectiveness. We estimate 5,000 annually in services for a consultant to facilitate meetings and compile a report. This will be funded by the Mental Health Trust Authority from FY17 through 19. Under Section 29, we would implement a primary care case management system. We'd contract with the Administrative Services Organization for a monthly per member per month fee beginning in the second quarter of FY18. We project that primary care case management would reduce many services but would increase physician services, as well incur fees to the ASO. The net impact would be a $596,400 reduction in FY17, growing to a reduction of over $9.5 million in FY22. Under Section 30, we would implement the health home provision 2 years later. There would be net savings from that project of $3,430,000. This, is the more intensive care management for individuals with chronic conditions. There would be also be startup costs for MMIS and also for ongoing operations. Startup capital costs would be $1 million for each of the two projects, the primary care case management and the health homes. These are 90% federal, 10% general funds. The ongoing operation costs would be $65,000 for each. Section 30 directs the department to provide incentives for telehealth, including increasing capabilities for and reimbursement of telehealth. The department has included a $5,000 contract in the services line in FY17 to convene a work group and identify the barriers and the potential, and this will also be paid for by the Mental Health Trust Authority. We project savings in telehealth beginning in FY18, starting at $1.3 million and growing to $13.3 million in FY22. Section 31 authorizes the department to support private initiatives to reduce emergency room use. The department's role would include data sharing, support for prescription drug monitoring programs, support for electronic health record sharing, and development of a shared savings model. We anticipate implementing the shared savings model beginning in FY19. For the purposes of estimating costs, we assume that there would be one-time expenses to interface the PDMP and connect pharmacies with the health information exchange. This would be a $765,000 cost in FY17, 90% federal, 10% general funds. We also assume $20,000 in annual operating costs. We expect one-time MMIS changes for this of $1 million, capital again, 90-10 federal state money, and $65,000 in annual operating costs. We expect the net savings to the state after a shared savings with providers of $2,240,000 annually. Section 31 authorizes the department to contract with one or more coordinated care projects. We've assumed that we would implement this in FY19. We would expect it would result in an annual net savings of $1.5 million in general funds. There would be startup funds for technical development and consulting with $3,885,000 in capital costs at 90/10. There would be ongoing maintenance costs in the service line of $318,000 for provider outreach and support, and this would be 50% general fund, 50% federal fund. Section 38 directs the department to implement the federal policy on Medicaid tribal reimbursement. Department estimates the health care Medicaid services component would see a shift from general funds to federal funds for travel and ambulance services. Again, this is not a change in total expenditures, just a fund source shift. With aggressive startup efforts, we estimate that this will begin with a $26.7 million shift in FY17 and eventually grow to a $44.2 million shift in FY21 and 22. And there's a table with the figures on page 6. So Section 39 directs the department to implement a health information infrastructure plan to support transformation of the healthcare system in the state. We estimate a one-time services cost of $5,000 in FY17 for a consultant to facilitate meetings and compile a report of recommendations. This would be funded by the Mental Health Trust Authority. We also estimate capital costs to fund requirements gathering, development roadmap and gap analysis, and design and engineering implementation plan with phases and achievement goals. And this would be $775,000. Again, this is 90/10 federal state money. The combined impact of all these changes is an increase in expenditures in the FY17 appropriation request of $337,200 with a $20.2 million reduction in the general fund match. The fiscal note also shows the FY17 impacts of the tribal policy change that were already included in the governor's budget. In FY18, there is a decrease of almost $3.8 million in total expenditures and a reduction in general fund match of over $35 million. In FY19, when most of the projects have started, there's a net reduction of over $16 million in total operating expenditures and a $45 million reduction in general fund match. This reduction continues to grow until it reaches over $60 million in general fund match by FY22. Combined capital costs for all the projects are included under this fiscal note are $6.9 million. And again, they're 90% federal, 10% state funded. And that's the end of my summary of that fiscal note.
That's a complicated one. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I hate to act like a broken record, but maybe just using the terminology. So on page 3, we can say civil forfeiture, and you keep telling me it's not civil forfeiture, but it's in the bill, fiscal note. And actually, you have annual recovery from civil forfeiture is estimated to be $282,500. Where does that $282,500 come from, since you can't do it now?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, with the provisions of this bill, the forfeiture provisions essentially allow us to protect assets of a provider while we're pursuing the criminal cases against them. And so right now we may get judgments against providers, but they have no assets left by the time we get the criminal conviction. So this allows us to Sometimes it's referred to as seize and freeze, but basically restrict providers' access to their assets while the case is in process. And if we prevail, then we recover against those assets. And so this would be the increased recovery by preserving the assets of the provider.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So again, how do you come up with $282,500? I mean, that's your figure, not mine.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the calculation is described in the fiscal note in terms of kind of based on historic overpayments and restitution amounts due from providers who might be subject to civil forfeiture. And we estimate that overall there's about each year there's about 2.8 million that would be subject to that, but we only estimated about 10% of that amount would actually be recoverable through the civil forfeiture. So that's how they came up with the number.
Follow-up.
Representative Wilson.
Although I'm not an attorney, nor do I pretend to be one. So you're telling me right now that in a criminal case, there is no way through the criminal process to freeze any assets whatsoever, that you must do it civilly.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think that's a question that an attorney would have to answer as to what aspect of this is in the criminal versus is in the civil. It's my understanding that this allows us access to a process that is prior to the criminal conviction, allows us to preserve the assets, and we refer to that as a civil forfeiture because it comes before the criminal conviction has been obtained. But it is my understanding it is really part of the process of pursuing a criminal case. And
come right up. And
I think I am having a lifeline come to my aid here.
Place yourself on the record, please.
Thank you. For the record, Stacey Creeley, Chief Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Law. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, Deputy Commissioner Sherwood is correct. What we have designed, there is no mechanism now, absent statutory authority, to seize property through a criminal prosecution. And so what we have asked through this bill to do is to create a separate process, which will be done through a civil forfeiture, which is exactly what Deputy Commissioner Sherwood said, is that we will then go to the court and we will say we have probable cause to believe that criminal fraud has occurred. We will petition the court and we will provide that information. And if the court agrees with us, the court will then give us the authority to place liens or to seize certain assets that we have identified. And at the end of the proceeding, should an individual be convicted of the fraud, then we would go back to the court and say, you know, individual X has been convicted of Medicaid fraud. We identified these assets. The amount that is owed to the state is, say, $50,000 or $100,000. There's $100,000 in assets here, or there's $300,000 in assets. We want permission to have those assets forfeited to the state so that we can convert those to offset the recovery that we have identified through the criminal fraud that has been identified.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So is this, whether it would be a drug bust or be anything else, so through no criminal type of prosecution can our criminal attorneys freeze people's assets? I mean, I just find that hard to believe that through the criminal process, as something's being committed, that we can't make sure things, you know, aren't frozen.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there are very limited seizure provisions under existing state statute and provisions, and the one that I'm most familiar with is in fish and game, where if you have a fish and game violation, you can seize and seek seizure and forfeiture of fishing gear from a fish and game violation and that sort of thing. I'm not familiar with, unlike on the federal side, where in a federal prosecution for a drug arrest, there's a broad federal authority for seizure and forfeiture of assets related to the commission of a crime. That similar authority does not exist in state statute right now. And all this bill does and all this provision does is provide a very limited capture of assets for forfeiture for individuals who have been convicted of Medicaid fraud. And if I may, we presented this as part of the legislative packet because when Mr. Peterson testified, or we talked to you last week, he has convicted a number of individuals for Medicaid fraud. Some of them have been corporations or businesses. And when we came back to get the recovery of the hundreds of thousands of dollars that we had identified in fraudulent payments, all of their assets had been dissipated. There was nothing to go after. Even if we had wanted to, there was no assets to go after. They had transferred interest in their homes. They had, you know, cashed out their bank accounts. They had sold their boats and their RVs or whatever they had done. And so in the prior Commissioner Struer was very interested in how we could make the state whole, and this was one of the ways that we could make the state whole, was to seek seizure and forfeiture in those very narrow circumstances where criminal fraud, Medicaid fraud, has been established.
Mr. Chairman, where I'm uncomfortable in this, and I don't think you meant to say they were convicted because they're not convicted yet. We're doing this on a much lower threshold that they may have done it. When we're looking at, I mean, I don't want anybody to commit fraud, don't get me wrong, you know, if they're guilty of it. But we could also ruin a person's life by taking their things, freezing them while they're waiting for their time in court. And what we've seen in Fishing Game, I'm glad you brought that one up, people who've been found not guilty of those things and still not be able to get their things back. So, you know, maybe it doesn't seem like a big deal to you, but it is to me, because we're adding something in here that can have negative consequences to our providers because our system isn't as fast as it should be when it's a criminal case. And what you could actually seize and what was actually there is up to your discretion. And so whenever we take something down to a lower threshold, I'm just really nervous about being able to do that. And I'm not convinced that there's not some other way of being able to recoup our costs than to give this kind of authority. So I'm sure we'll get to discuss that when we get more into the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This, Mr. Sherwood, this is probably an appropriate time for me to bring up a question I'd asked earlier. You deferred my question to a later fiscal note. It pertains to the question of interest charged to a Medicaid provider who might find out that he has inadvertently made an overpayment and confesses, self-identifies, and repays within 60 days as per the bill. My question is someone who does go through that process, are they likely to be subject to interest and penalties, even if they self-identify and pay back within 60 days?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, no. The interest is really intended to start the clock on interest running when we have come to the conclusion of an audit process, either when our final audit is issued and not disputed, or when the appeal of an audit is come to conclusion. It really is not intended to address those self-reporting requirements of overpayments who give us make us timely repayment or work out a payment plan with us.
So to clarify for the record, so somebody in that condition situation is not subject to interest.
No.
What I described. Okay. And it would only start at the end of an audit. Where would I find the documentation that interest would only begin at the end of an audit?
Just a minute. Let me look at the bill.
I'm starting at page 7, line 17.
Okay. So, through the chair, Representative Sadler.
Line 21.
Yeah. Well, the around the actual interest, That's referring to 4705-0200, which is our audit statute, and that on the top of page 23, essentially lines 2 through 7, talks about when that date of the interest starts in there. It's the date of issuance of the final agency decision is the later of the department's written notification of the decision and the provider's appeal rights, or if appealed, timely appeal by the provider of the final agency decision. So that's what governs when the audit starts. The provisions on line 21 and 22 make it of that page make it clear that the interest and penalties do not apply to the section regarding self-identified overpayments.
Thank you very much, Bill. Sure. All right. Seeing no further questions, we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My final fiscal note. So senior and disabilities, Medicaid services, OMB component 2662. Dated March 17th, and this fiscal note reflects the impact to the senior and disabilities Medicaid services component for the addition of the 1915 I and K Medicaid options, as well as the impact of the tribal claiming policy change. Section 30 of the bill directs the department to apply for the 1915 I option for home and community-based services, and it shifts coverage of services from other programs that are 100% general funds to Medicaid, which is 50% federal funds, and those shifts have been identified in the prior fiscal notes. We talked about those three programs that would be impacted. And so, again, that's this is a fiscal note where the actual Medicaid expenditures show up. Those are 50% federal, 50% general funds. So while that would increase general fund expenditures, you've seen that offset in other fiscal notes. Section 30 also directs the department to implement the 1915K option for home and community-based services. The K option will cover personal care services currently provided to Medicaid 1915C waiver recipients. However, the 1915K services come with an additional 6% federal match. So the federal match for these services changed from 50% to 56%. We expect this shift to reduce general fund match by a little over $2.5 million per year, and we anticipate it will start beginning at the beginning of FY18. It'll require, to implement these two options, will require capital costs of $1.2 million to make changes to the MMIS, and these are 90% federal, 10% general funds. Section 38 of the bill directs the department to implement the new tribal, the federal policy on tribal claiming. And this will shift some nursing home and home and community-based services presently claimed at 50% federal funds to 100% federal funds. We will implement beginning in FY17, starting with nursing homes, and expand to home and community-based waivers services in FY19. That delay is really to give a chance of some of these other changes that are occurring with the home and community-based services providers. In addition to changes in this bill, there's other federal changes being implemented right now. The shift grows from $2.9 million in FY17 to over $42 million in FY22. The combined impact of these provisions for FY17 is a $0 change in operating costs with a $2.9 million shift in general fund match to federal funds in the governor's FY17 request. The fund source shifts continues in FY18 as we add the 1915K option, but we also start to see increased spending associated with the 1915I option halfway through the year. The increase in expenditures in FY18 is just a little over $5.6 million. But the net reduction in general funds for that year is almost $4.8 million. In FY19 and beyond, when 1959 is fully implemented, we see increased annual expenditures of about $17 million. But again, due to the growth in the tribal claiming for long-term care services, The general fund match continues to reduce for the remainder of the years of the fiscal note for a net reduction of almost $17.2 million in FY19, growing to almost $36.6 million in FY22.
All right. Questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. On the top of page 3 of 3, there is a note of a capital expenditure of $1.2 million for the MMIS system change. And it's been a long day. It's going to be a long night still. But I guess the general question I want to ask about SB 74 and MMIS is that computer system going to be running, certified, and able to do all that we anticipate it will have to do for us to realize the benefits of the reform in this bill?
I missed the first part of the question.
Is MMS going to work?
Yes, MIS is going to work. Certainly these changes are not easy, and we do have to be careful to stage our different things so that not every change is made at exactly the same time. But, yes, we should be able to implement all of these changes.
Is the MMIS system federally certified now?
Mr. Chair, it is not federally certified now. We are scheduled to have our certification review in June of this year, of this summer.
Very interesting. All right, further questions? Seeing none, that's the last fiscal note.
I surrender.
We're now going to move to Jeff Jesse.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. I'll be going through this three-page spreadsheet, hopefully mercifully rather quickly. I don't know if yours is stapled a little incorrectly as mine is, so you might want to rip off the top page and put it in order. I'm going to start with page one. But let me start by giving you the context for this. The trustees testified very early on in the Senate Bill 74 process that, in their view, Medicaid reform is the most important thing that has happened to the beneficiaries and the trust since the creation of the trust in 1995. And the reason for that is that the current Medicaid program is unsustainable. Our behavioral health system does not provide comprehensive care in an efficient and effective manner, leaving many beneficiaries unserved. So they signaled very early in the process that they intended to step forward and provide some financial assistance to the state, as we have on many other initiatives across the years. Bring the Kids Home, to refresh your memory, the trustees spent nearly $16 million in trust funds over 7 years in order to allow you to repurpose well over $30 million in general funds from out-of-state programs into in-state services. So when we started to look at the development of the bill, obviously a lot of the focus was on the substantive provisions. When it got to the point where the fiscal notes were starting to be discussed, it was clear that there were certain fiscal note areas that were more difficult for Senate Finance, and presumably you as well, to fund, given the fiscal gap and the fiscal crisis. And the different directives that have come out to try to be efficient and effective with state resources. So, for example, one of the things that came out very early on were virtually all of the new positions that are required to do the work, the non-perm positions that are necessary either to actually do the work or to backfill the jobs of people that are currently at the department so they can use their specialized expertise to get these things underway. Now, we understand why that was the case. Adding state employees at state expense in this environment is certainly problematic. But we then asked the department, so how are you going to get the work done? Because failure is not an option. And the answer was, well, we will work longer, harder, smarter, faster. Well, frankly, we think the department already works pretty darn fast and smart and hard and long. So that didn't seem like a successful strategy. And so you'll see as we go through here where the trust has been willing to step forward and say, look, you got to have the warm bodies to get this job done. That's just all there is to it. Another area that we step forward on is travel. You know, we are a long way from the places that have already accomplished a lot of these results that we're looking for. We've learned at the trust over the years, as we did with Housing First, as we did with other programs, like in Bring the Kids Home, that doing site visits and actually taking groups of folks to places where they have successfully done the types of things that we're trying to do is really very, very valuable and important. Not only because seeing is believing, and connecting with peers that have a similar perspective can really help you individually figure out what to do, but also the fact that those teams then have several days together to sort of start to get a common understanding of what it is that they're trying to do. Obviously, right now, additional state funds for out-of-state travel is certainly not something that is looked upon very favorably, but it's something that the trustees were willing to provide as well. In addition, there were a number of one-time expenses that we'll go through that we felt were essential in order to get these things done on time. And another thing I'll point out is that, again, the process of getting the substantive elements in the bill is what created the questions that we needed to ask, which is what are we trying to accomplish and how fast do we have to work to accomplish them? And so when those fiscal notes were initially submitted, they didn't always anticipate all the steps that would be required to meet each of the substantive requirements in the timeline outline. So one of the things that we did with the department was to sit down with Charlie Curie's associate, Stephanie Colston, and really work with the department and Ms. Colston to go through, okay, exactly what do we have to do in each of the steps in order to get this done on time, and where are we going to get the resources for that? So with that, and then at the end, I will answer Representative Guerra's question as to, well, where did we come up with the funding to do these things? But let's start on page one. Items one through four are really built around the 1115 waiver process. Item number one is the Division of Behavioral Health Capacity Assessment and Development. In FY17 and FY18, one of the things that the department has talked about is the role of the division will change. As we have an administrative services organization, eventually there may be fewer people at the division. So there needs to be an assessment of the knowledge, skills, and abilities of current staff compared to what the division's job is going to have to be in the future, and then how do we get from here to there? Yes.
Representative Guerra has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's really up to the other members of the committee, but I feel like we went through the fiscal notes, including the MTARP portions. I mean, I'm certainly interested in the question of the overall question of the Mental Health Trust's approach to this, but on the individual fiscal notes, I feel like we understand them by now, but maybe I'm wrong about that. So I don't know if it's my expression that I don't think we have to go through each one of these.
We do have that overall coverage that we looked at also.
And Representative Guerra, if I might, through the chair, you will note in a number of these areas, these trust investments are not in the fiscal notes. They are additional resources the trust is making available outside of the state budget.
All right.
The second one here, which is another area where we're spending money not through the state budget, is, okay, so we assess the division and where it needs to go. The next step is to assess the providers. And so we'll be looking at what are the providers doing, what do they need to do in the future, and looking at how we're going to provide them technical assistance so that they're ready to implement the new system. Item three is the actual waiver itself. These are in the fiscal notes. But, for example, we talked about the actuarial analysis, who's going to actually do the analysis. That's part of what was funded in the fiscal notes.
Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you, sure. Real briefly, Jeff, under 2, CCG, is that?
That's the Charlie Curie group.
Thank you.
All right, go ahead.
And then number four is the Administrative Services Organization, and that's where the trust has agreed to step forward and do two things. One is you can see the travel costs. The reference to the three department, one mental health trust staff and one consultant, that's flexible. That may not be exactly what that team looks like. But the point is that we will want to go actually out and see some of these administrative service organizations and how they operate. And then the trustees have agreed to pick up the ASO cost, the state match for FY18 and FY19. That directly supplants general funds that were in the fiscal note. If you look at page 2, primary care integration, one of the things you need for a waiver is to demonstrate that you are implementing evidence-based practices which will increase the effectiveness of the program. There are two here. One is to support screening, brief intervention, referral, and treatment in two hospital ER rooms. As you probably know, a lot of ER visits are the result of substance abuse. People drink, they take drugs, they wreck their four-wheeler, they have auto accidents, they fall off the ladder painting their ceiling. What we know from the evidence is that screening and brief intervention in the ER for those substance abuse issues is actually an effective strategy to reduce drinking and subsequent emergency room visits. So we'll be supporting pilots in two ERs, and also a standardized screening and assessment instrument in three federally qualified health centers and behavioral health centers. So we need to start standardizing the assessment instruments, and again, we'll be funding those off budget. Number 6, these are piloting a prospective payment pilot with either a substance abuse or a substance abuse and mental health provider. Number 7 is the data. Well, if we're going to have a health information exchange, gee, we have to hook the providers up to it. Well, initially the thought was rather than ask for this money in a fiscal note, we'll just leave that cost to the providers. And it'll be an unfunded mandate that they'll just have to pick up on their own. It's not a huge amount of money, but we're asking the providers to do a lot in terms of changing their entire system and how they operate in many ways. And so the trustees have agreed to cover the cost of that connectivity. And then the next one, the next couple are very important, particularly the third one, which is enhance AK AIMS to full capacity. Right now what happens is the provider has to enter all of their information in AK AIMS, and then if you hook them up to the health information exchange, they have to go over and re-enter all that data in the health information exchange. Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's part of what drives up the administrative costs, and so what we're willing to pay for is basically making it so that AK AIMS, once you enter that data, it will automatically populate your health information exchange, which should significantly reduce the administrative burdens on nonprofits.
Mr. Jesse, Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the principle that you don't put bald tires on a new car, we're talking about plussing up the health information exchange. I guess I'm going to ask the question to anybody there. What is this assessment of the health information exchange? I don't know much about it, what it is, how it operates. I can make some assumptions, but I don't know how old it is. Is it an appropriate vehicle to begin adding utility to, or should we replace it entirely?